Accession number 19666, Real 1.
San Cheverson, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
Peterborough, Northamptonshire, England, 7th of January, 1922.
Did you grow up and have your education at Peterborough?
Yes.
Where did you go to school?
I started off at an elementary school, Lincoln Road School, and I then went to the King's School, or Peterborough Cathedral Grammar School.
What was your family background? What did your father do for a living and so on?
My father was an engineer's fitter. Sometimes called himself a millwright.
And so, when did you leave the grammar school?
I left when I went for my first year to Cambridge, and that would have been in 1940.
So the war had already started?
The war had already started, and I had participated in the evacuation of children from London. I had been a member of the LDV, the Local Defence Volunteers, and also of the Paston branch of the Peterborough Home Guard before I went to the university and went into the Officers' Training Corps.
Just let me stop you there. Can you tell me your memories of evacuating the children from London, please?
Oh, certainly. It was all rather sad. There were so many people locally who would not take the children in. And we, and my wife was one of the people too, from the local girls' grammar school, those who wouldn't take people in, we had to take all those children back to the town hall where they could find somewhere for them to live. That isn't to say this happened to the majority, but it happened, as far as I was concerned, to a significant number.
Was it because of them wanting, not liking particular children, or not like wanting any children at all?
I think it was didn't want any children at all, didn't want to be troubled, claimed they didn't have enough room. And then, of course, there was the usual business that they were dirty and smelly, that sort of stuff.
Were they dirty and smelly?
No, I don't think so, but there we are.
But they said they were?
Some people did, yes.
Why was it that you got involved with this job?
I was a senior boy at school, and when all these children landed in several droves at Peterborough Station from London, all hands to the pumps, as it were, as many people as possible to take them around to selected addresses in Peterborough.
How had the addresses been arrived at?
I have no idea. That was done at the town hall. We were simply told where to take them.
Were the children distressed or excited or what?
I'd say a mixture of both. If anything, I think they were more puzzled than anything else, perplexed as to what was happening.
What kind of ages were they?
All sorts of ages, I should say, from about 10 to 14.
Do you know whereabouts in London they had come from?
No, I have no idea. No idea, really. But they're all Cockneys with strong Cockney accents.
And you were just going around the town of Peterborough?
Yes, yes. I was still a schoolboy when I joined the LDV, which was the precursor of the Home Guard.
Which unit of the LDV did you join?
It was the Paston Peterborough unit.
Is that part of Peterborough?
Yes, Paston is a suburb of Peterborough. Then very rural, now totally built over, but we used to go out and about 5 o'clock in the morning and look up in the sky to see the German parachutists landing. We once built a concrete bunker over there.
Can you tell me about the Paston LDV, its composition, and what you did?
Well, I can tell you one story, which is not to my credit, but it's all part of documentary history. We used to get up in the morning, those of us who were going on the patrols, about six at a time, and I'd leave my mother and father's house about 4:30 in the morning and get on my bike and go down to the house, which was about 1.5 miles down the road, to the section leader. He was in bed, but he used to leave the... It's all very much like Dad's army. He used to leave the key for his back door on the top of the outside lavatory cistern, and you go there and stand on the seat of the lavatory, get the key from the top of the cistern, go and open the back door, and there, leaning on his old-fashioned copper in the kitchen, was your rifle and a clip of 5 rounds. You do that, you go on the patrol, and usually about 2.5 hours until the dawn came up, and you come back, and you go and open his back door when you had already taken the rounds out of your 303 Lee Enfield and dumped the rifle. Well, on this particular Sunday morning, we'd had a usually non-eventful patrol around the fens, and I came back, and before I opened the door to leave my rifle, I went on to his lawn at the back. I worked the bolt backwards and forwards, ejected, as I felt, all the rounds. Then, of course, you press the trigger and the bolt comes forward. I was only about 16 at the time, and I had left one round up the spout. So I pressed the trigger, and there was a very large hole in his lawn. I could have shot somebody because there were houses at the back, and if I'd held the rifle in the air, I would no doubt have put a round through somebody's back window. But I can remember filling in the hole. Nobody heard this bang. Filling in the hole and scattering loose grass all over it, putting the 4 rounds back in the clip and putting them in the back kitchen, and putting the key back on the top of the cistern in the outdoor lavatory, and I never heard any more about that. And I can assure you that that rather silly young man who's in Dad's army was me in those days.
Was it mostly people of your own age? In the
army? Oh, no, there were one or two young people, but most of them were mid-40s. I was recruited by the local hairdresser, a man called Horace Henson. I certainly acquired an interesting military experience in the Home Guard.
Did you get much training in it?
Very little. We fired 5 rounds at the local firing range, which was at the local aerodrome. We did a certain amount of route marching. We went on church parades. But didn't get much training. Not even when we built a bunker. We just went and put the bricks up and a lot of mixed concrete and shoved them up, and that was it.
Did you actually hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh, yes.
Under what circumstances?
I was at home with my mother, so took place. And I remember it very well.
What was your reaction to the news?
I wasn't at all surprised, because I used to read quite actively the various papers. I wasn't at all surprised.
Were you in favour of the declaration of war?
Well, I was only about 16 or 17 when it took place, and I think the answer might be yes and no, because I felt that something ought to be done about fascism. I remember seeing at the local Odeon cinema the first Russian film I'd ever seen, which was put on general release, about the persecution of the Jews in Germany, was called Professor Mamluk. It made quite a big impression locally. Now, whatever has happened to that film, I don't know. On the other hand, when I say no, I was under the influence of a family, local family, whose son signed up as a conscientious objector. And while I wouldn't have done this myself, I did have feelings that war was not necessarily a good thing. And I had already seen All Quiet on the Western Front and read Remarque's novel, so there was a certain amount of pacifism there as well. But on the whole, I was in favour. Otherwise, I don't suppose I would have joined the Home Guard.
Had you by then formed any particular political attitude?
Not particularly, except my father was a Labour Party member and a fairly strong trade unionist, and I was on the left. I remember at the time I saw Professor Mamluk being quite deeply moved by the movie that was made. I think it was the first film in which Deborah Carr starred at any level, of Walter Greenwood's Love on the Dole. But I also had some further interesting war experience before I went into the army proper. In my first long vacation from the university, I went down to the Labour Exchange to get a job, and they put me with an elementary flying training school at Peterborough Aerodrome, which was then run by de Havilland's, of training pilots in Tiger Moths. In fact, I remember catching two flights from the pilots and went up over Peterborough. But that was quite an interesting job because I kept pilots' logbooks and did little things on the planes. And then, of course, I was in the university corps for a couple of years. So I had a mixed experience before I went into the army proper.
But you hadn't been a member of a political organisation at that time?
No, no.
What subjects had you studied in the sixth form?
In the sixth form, after I did the school certificate, I did the higher school certificate, and I did advanced English, advanced history, Latin, French, and divinity.
And you chose to do which subject at university?
I did part one of the English Tripos, although I went up with a local exhibition which King's School Peterborough shared with Arundel Public School down the road, called the Mount Stephen Exhibition. Then I got a first in my first year, and on the basis of that I was made an exhibitioner of the college. And in my second year I got another first, and I got a scholarship, college scholarship, so I became a scholar of St John's College, Cambridge.
And this is 1940?
That would be 1940, yes. Yes.
Was Cambridge University at all affected by the Second World War at that time?
Oh, yes. One of the things that affected it very greatly was the presence in Cambridge of a lot of students who'd been decanted from London University, in particular the LSE. And I always regret that I never attended any of the lectures of the famous professor, although he's totally forgotten about nowadays at LSE, who was then living in Cambridge. That is Harold Lasky.
What impression did he make on you?
I didn't attend any of his lectures. I felt I ought to have done, because my father, who used to go to the local Labour Hall, they were frequently addressed by Harold Lasky. It was the first time I ever heard the word professor used. Was when my father came back and said, "We've had a most interesting man speaking at the Labour Hall tonight, Professor Lasky from London." I think that the LSE had a very, very big effect on Cambridge. There is a plaque up on the wall, I think, of one of the Fitzwilliam houses to say that this was the headquarters of LSE. It's just opposite the Fitzwilliam Museum.
Why do you think? In what way do you think they made a big impression on Cambridge?
Well, Cambridge was still in the 40s, a fairly upper-class area, whereas the LSE people weren't necessarily upper-class, they were much more mixed. And then, of course, the LSE brought a very substantial element of left-wing politics into Cambridge, although obviously Cambridge wasn't lacking in left-wing politics, as we now know from the story of Philby and Co. And it filled the city up with people. The impression that Cambridge was very full of young people bicycling around all over the place.
Apart from studying for Tripos, what were your out of curriculum activities?
Well, I did a certain amount with the Socialist Club. I did a certain amount of local speaking. I don't know why it was, but I was always in great demand for giving talks on all sorts of things. I think this was through the local librarian of the English faculty, who used to get me to go and talk to his WEA group, and I used to speak on all sorts of things. I was also a member of the English Club Committee. That was in my first year there when I met the first World War poet, who's now virtually forgotten about, Robert Nichols, who came back from France, and he was living in Cambridge. And I persuaded him to speak to the English club in Cambridge. He wouldn't speak, but he read a collection or selection of poetry from his contemporaries. And he knew all of them, Brooke and Sassoon and all the rest of them. I can also remember Robert Nichols sitting in one of the college rooms in Cambridge, it was John's College, and he read about 10 or 12 poems, and naturally he read Brooke's famous sonnet, If I Should Die, Think Only This of Me, etc. And there was a great titter went around from the student audience, because this was the age of Auden & Co. And he dropped his book and said, well, young ladies and gentlemen, you may laugh, but that's how middle-class English people felt at that time, which always struck me as a fairly sensible thing to have done on paper. I also remember chairing the English Club when J.D. Brunofsky, the man who did the famous TV popular science series, gave a talk on Blake, William Blake. And he'd just written his book called A Man Without a Mask, which was a precursor of Edward Thompson's great book on Blake. I met some very interesting people there. I also, for a short time, I did a certain amount of rowing, but I found that was taking up too much time, so I stopped that. And one of the things of Cambridge at the beginning of the war when I was there, which was very interesting, was the Cambridge Arts Theatre, which J.M. Keynes had founded. And we had some quite remarkable plays came down there from London or tried out there. And I used to go pretty regularly to the Arts Theatre. And the play I remember most has never been done again. This was the play by Sean O'Casey, who did Juno and the Peacock and all those other Irish plays. He wrote a very patriotic play called Oak Leaves and Lavender, about country house support for the war effort. It's been totally forgotten about. They repeat all sorts of O'Casey's plays in Dublin, but they don't repeat O'Casey's Oak Leaves and Lavender. I remember seeing there the great British actor, who in my opinion was the best speaker of English verse alive at the time, Robert Donat, appearing in Shaw's Devil's Disciple. And of course, a great deal of my time, in my 2 years at Cambridge before I went in the regular army, was taken up with 2 to 3, and sometimes more, afternoons a week and weekends with the officer cadet training unit.
How did O'Casey's patriotic play go down?
I think it caused a lot of titters in the Cambridge audience. They wanted something much more left-wing from O'Casey. But I've never forgotten it. It was an interesting play.
Did you feel inclined to titter yourself?
Inclined to what?
To titter yourself?
No, not at all. Then I'm very tolerant of all sorts of viewpoints.
Any personal memories of Brunofsky?
Except that after the war, his sister turned up in Edinburgh where I went to teach. And I remember her quite well. Her name was Lily Stein. She often spoke of her brother. But the memories I have of Brunofsky was the tremendous literary culture he got. I mean, not only did Brunofsky train as a scientist, but one of the things he did when he was at Cambridge is now virtually forgotten about. He used to write the programme notes for the old Festival Theatre in Cambridge. And if you can get a complete set of Brunofsky's programme notes to the Festival Theatre, and you've got a commercial asset. The man I remember most who spoke to the English Club was Robert Nichols, the poet.
What was he like as a man?
Well, he'd been, after the First World War, he went to Japan as one of the English professors at one of the Japanese universities. And I can remember that when he came back from this country, he wrote a radio play based on his Japanese experiences called Komuso, which is the Japanese word for a type of flute. In fact, I think that Nichols and his play Komiso on the BBC was my first introduction to Japan.
What were these speeches which you were giving in Cambridge?
On all sorts of things. I gave literary talks, I suppose I gave elementary talks on socialism, because like a lot of other young men at the time, I'd been greatly influenced by the late John Strachey's Left Book Club volume called The Theory and Practice of Socialism. I can remember that I joined, although I wasn't reading economics, I joined the Marshall Society, which was named after the great Cambridge economist, because Strachey was coming down to talk to it, and this was when he was shifting his viewpoint to a more liberal viewpoint in the Labour Party, and the title of his talk was Towards a Mixed Economy. Well, now we've really mixed the economy nowadays, and I think I can say I was there when Strachey started that particular direction in the Labour Party.
How did the audience receive that?
It was fairly well received.
Now, can you tell me about going into the army, please?
Yes. I got, as most of my undergraduate generation did in Cambridge, what they called Cert A and Cert B, in the Octoon. And then when I had taken my war degree, the BA, you got it for 2 years then, about almost 57 years ago today, almost, I was called up. I'd already got my uniform from the Octoon, and I went down to 6 weeks very intensive training at Rootham in Kent. That's where the traditional Pilgrim's Way is to Canterbury. And after 6 weeks there, when I once again showed that my control over the rifle was not all it should be. We were once advancing down a tunnel and with live ammunition, and I slipped and my finger got on the trigger and I let off a bullet which ricocheted right down the tunnel. And I wish you had somebody with a tape recorder to have recorded that. I got ticked off, but I wasn't sent down for it. But after 6 weeks there, I was sent to 6 months Octoon at Douglas in the Isle of Man. That was an extremely interesting experience, because in those days there were still a few old people left on the island who only had Manx as a language and no English at all. Our commanding officer, we used to think he was a veritable bastard, but then I suppose everybody did in those days, he was David Niven's brother, and he looked like a rather fat version of David Niven. But they really put us through it in those days. There was no mercy. And, of course, going to the Isle of Man between October and April, that was the cold season.
This is 43, did you say?
No, that was 42. It was commissioned in 43. And that it would be October 42 to April 43. We went virtually over the whole Isle of Man, and we had a pretty rugged existence. I received my first war wound in the Isle of Man, I can remember. This was the days when assault courses and live ammunition were being used in training, and I was in the countryside with our company, swinging across a stream on a rope, and it was very wet, as it was almost all the time in the Isle of Man. And I went from one bank to the other. And when my feet got on the bank on the other side of the stream, I slipped backwards because the bank was wet. And I fell on a lot of old tin cans in the stream and cut my arm very badly. So I was deputed by the officer in charge to run back to Onkenhead Hospital with one of our other chaps accompanying me. And I went back there holding my arm, and it was sewn up without any anaesthetic, with an awesome-looking needle. and I carted that around with me for 3 months. So I was a war-wounded soldier before I ever got commissioned.
How much use was all this to you?
Pardon?
How much use was all this?
Oh, enormous use, enormous use. I have no doubt whatsoever that 6 months at the Octu in the Isle of Man was extremely good training. We had an excellent series of lectures. We had really tough schemes in the countryside. We had one scheme, which was around Snaefell. I suppose that's a small mountain you could call it, couldn't you, in the Isle of Man. When the wind was so intense that we had to lean forward almost 45 degrees with packs on our backs to not to be blown over. And it was quite tough. Although I eventually went to Burma, I still look upon that training as absolutely basic. It knocked out of me my episodes in letting off rifles prematurely and all that sort of thing.
In all this training that you were doing since call-up, how much of it, of this training, was devoted to what you might call knocking the civilian out of you?
A fair amount. But I think more of knocking the civilian out of us took place at Rootham in Kent in the 6 weeks period, which was all university graduates from all over the country before we went to the Isle of Man.
In what way does the army knock the civilian out of you?
Well, just by keeping you running around and telling you that you're a dozy bastard, Shepherdson, or something like that. I can well remember the Irish drill sergeants we had. And giving us, I'm sure you could record this word, what used to be known in those days as a right bollocking if anything went wrong, and so on and so on. I wasn't a civilian for very long after the middle of 1942.
And after the Isle of Man?
After the Isle of Man, an incident of that introduced me to the sea between Fleetwood and Douglas. I had 6 trips on the boat, and I was seasick on 5 occasions. But I'm happy to say when I finally returned from Douglas to Fleetwood in April, the sea was calm, and therefore my beautiful new officer's uniform was not in any way damaged. But after the Isle of Man, I was posted to Sheringham in Norfolk with the 6 Northamptons. And I had expected to go abroad with some of the Northamptonshire regiments people, but I didn't. What we were doing at Sheringham was really marking time and doing various exercises, and nominally on coastal defence, because the Sheringham beach had got barbed wire and bits of concrete shoved around it, but there was really no danger of invasion at that time. And then after I'd been there couple of months or so, a group of us in the 6 Northamptons, we were mainly university graduates, were sent on embarkation leave, and then we got down to London. There was a hotel or something that was used for people going overseas in Marylebone, I think it was, and we were got in the train and went from, I think it was Paddington, I could be wrong, up to Greenock, and we got on the boat, and it wasn't until we were a long way out of the harbour that we were told that we were going to Cape Town for East Africa. You might be interested in the ship that took us to Cape Town. It was an American vessel called the John Ericsson. And this American vessel, the John Ericsson, it's